Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger. And unless you've been living under a rock, you've heard about the Benedict option, which has been making circles in the Catholic news outlets the last few months. Today, we're going to be talking about another option, and we're going to take a deep dive into what it means to have an option and what in particular Mary has to do with it. My guest today is Carrie Gress, and she is the author of The Marian Option, God's Solution to a Civilization in Crisis from Tan Books. Carrie has a doctorate in philosophy from the Catholic University of America and is a faculty member at Pontifex University. Dr. Gress is a regular blogger to National Catholic Register, Catholic Vote, Catholic World Report, The Stream, and Zenit, and she's a frequent guest on Ave Maria Radio, EWTN Radio, and Relevant Radio. She's also the author of Nudging Conversions, a practical guide to bringing those you love back to the church, Ultimate Makeover, the Transforming Power of Motherhood, and co-author with George Weigel of City of Saints, a pilgrim's guide to John Paul II's Krakow. And most importantly, she's a homeschooling mother of four, so we have some common ground already. Welcome to the show, Carrie Gress.
Hi, Pete. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. So I want to dive into your book here, and first of all, I think to get a firm foundation to move forward in today's show, what is the Marian option? Some of us are probably very curious and confused as to what this option is and what this whole option discussion is that's been going on recently.
Right. Well, the option phenomenon has certainly started with Rod Dreher when he started talking about the Benedict option. And this is something that I was intrigued by. I have a great love of Benedict, and I thought, what's he getting at here? And so I started looking into it, and basically the idea of these options is, how is it that Christians can deal with the culture that we find ourselves in today, whether it's religious persecution or civilizational rot, or, you know, all the things that it feels like we're facing, just, you know, even the daily news cycle, I think it can be overwhelming at times. And so the options are really a way to, how do we respond to these? How do we live our faith and, you know, even maintain our families and our faith through all of these obstacles that we have in the world today. So my idea of the Marian option then was really just a look at, okay, what's worked in the past? I have a PhD in philosophy, but my first love is really history. And so I started looking at what's been effective in the past. And, of course, St. Benedict of Norcia, who is the inspiration for the Benedict option, was very instrumental in saving civilization after the fall of Rome. But there are other situations that have arisen throughout history that have been obviously problematic. And so I started looking at, okay, the threat of Islam or heresies or Christians that needed protection and all of these other kinds of issues. And Mary just seemed to be really at the heart of all of them, you know, looking at just superficially, who's converted more people than anyone can count. Well, it's Our Lady at Our Lady of Guadalupe, you know, somewhere between 4 and 10 million people. And, you know, possibly the largest single site of a conversion in recorded history. So these kinds of things that jumped off the page at me, and certainly even the work that I did on the book City of Saints that I co-authored with George Weigel was really instrumental in this too, because I noticed that, you know, this is a man that lived under Christian persecution for most of his life. And so he was able to really give us a field guide to how we can live through that. But at the heart of John Paul II's witness was, again, this devotion to Our Lady. So all of these pieces kind of kept coming back for me to Mary and what it is that she's done for us. And even just the question of culture, too. She's been a huge inspiration in culture. So all of these were things that came together for me to really decide this was a book that was worth writing.
So to make it a little, I guess, easier for us to understand, what are some of the key differences you feel between the Benedict option and the Marian option?
Right. Well, I think the Benedict option, I'm very grateful to Rod Dreher for writing the Benedict option. I think that he's created this kind of international discussion that certainly didn't exist before, and I think it's important that we're talking about these things. But I think some of what Dreher's doing, and Dreher's been kind of a moving target, so it's hard to really pin him down sometimes between what he said and then what's in the book. I think there's a lot of great things in the book as far as just helping people return to what it is, you know, basic principles of living Christian communities on a local level and returning to our faith and through education of our children and through building up culture, these kinds of things that are there. And I think, but on the other hand, there's been certainly a lot of criticism because Dreher has a much more strong point about leaving the world of politics, and that cannot be, in fact, be a way to help right what's wrong in the world. So I think what's different about the Marian option, and I don't see this as necessarily something that competes with the Bennett option. I think the Marian option is actually more fundamental. I think what we see with the Marian option is that devotion to Our Lady is very specific to each individual, and that she, when we have an established this relationship with her, she's going to lead in each individual, like she led John Paul II, to live out the mission that God has given to them in their life. So for some, it might be following politics. For others, it might be something like a retreat to a monastery, and so on and so on. But I think that's the, for me, that's what it really came down to, was working with the Holy Spirit, working with Our Lady to help individuals really flourish and you know, follow God's will in this, instead of sort of trying to fit ourselves into a square peg, if we're that into that round hole, if we're a square peg. Because I know even the idea of a lot of people think of the Benedict option as retreating from the world, and a lot of us just don't have that kind of option in our life. We're tied down to urban centers and that kind of thing. So. Anyway, those seem to be, in my mind, that's the most significant difference, I think.
I think that pretty much clears it up. One side note I got to say here. I don't know who designed the cover of your book, but what an awesome-looking cover. When that came through in the mail,
didn't
I was
they
like,
do a great
wow.
Job?
Yeah, no.
I think they did an amazing job at Tamworth. I was so happy with it. And a lot of people haven't noticed that, actually, you see Our Lady's right hand on the front cover, and it's, of course, the cityscape of Chicago. Well, if you go look at the back cover, you can see her left hand and more of Chicago cityscape, so it wraps around the whole book. So, yeah, they just did an incredible job. I was so grateful for it.
Awesome. So, we have a couple more minutes left in this segment. I want to touch upon something because I can't help but reflect while I was reading this book and while I was preparing for the show today that our world needs something. I mean, it seems like the last few shows I recorded, the topic of how messed up a world really is keeps coming up.
Right.
And worse yet, every show before recording has had some kind of attack occur within a few days of recording. So how can the Marian option help people to deal with all this negativity and bad news?
Sure. Well, I think there's several things. The first is, even understanding history and civilizations and recognizing that civilizations, I looked at the historian Arnold Toynbee and his work about the 26 civilizations, how they rose, how they fell, et cetera, et cetera. And there was this common thread in them, this idea of a creative minority, and that it doesn't take a huge number of people to actually turn a civilization around. In fact, it happens through a small group of people. And I think as Catholics, as Christians, we are called to be that, you know, those seeds of you know, to sow throughout a new civilization. So I think in that sense, historically, it's very helpful. But I think the other element is to just recognize how powerful Our Lady is if we just ask her. And this is the one thing that, you know, I think is difficult because it seems so simple, but and it's such a humble idea, and it seems like it can't really work. Really, can the rosary really be that effective? And yet we know from Fatima and elsewhere that Our Lady has asked for this over and over again. And, you know, Christ even said to Blessed Alain de la Roche, who was a 15th century saint, or blessed, I should say, who helped promote the rosary, Christ said, If only they would pray my rosary, and he referred to it as his rosary. That's it's also we're meditating on the life of Christ, but it's a very simple idea, and I think oftentimes we are prone to complicate the problems in our world and see them as so just daunting and overwhelming. And even at Fatima, Mary told Sister Lucia. That the rosary could solve any material and especially spiritual problem in the world. And so it's, again, we're looking for very sophisticated problems or sophisticated answers to these problems. But I think it's very simple, and she knows our humanness and how to get through to transforming the world. Instead of making it too complicated, we just have to go back to basics, I think.
Right, and I think you raise a very good point here with the rosary in particular, because, you know, we're in a glitzy, glammy society that's real techie and wants to have the newest thing. And in essence, what we're telling people here to do is to go back to a fundamental prayer that's been with us for a long time, and some people just don't get that.
Yeah, well, and that even this foreshadowing of it, of course, in the Old Testament. I mean, look at David; he obviously didn't pick up just one stone. He probably picked up a bunch of stones, and that's what one of them slew Goliath. So there's this idea of something very small, a very small stone doing tremendous work in the Old Testament, and I think that's what she's asking us to do. It's very simple. We don't need to complicate it. And the fruit that will happen, you know, not just on a geopolitical scale, but also on our personal lives, is just tremendous. And this is the other wonderful side effects of it, is that it's not like we're praying this rosary and the graces leave us, when in fact they actually, they stay with us, they transform us and build up this relationship. And so many of us have very complicated problems within our own families, and there, you know, layer upon layer of issues that are there. And she really wants to help us undo those. That Our Lady Undoer of Knots, it seems to be such a great devotion for our age, because of the fact that just knot after knot in our own families. So, getting to this very simple solution, I think, is both hopeful and incredibly fruitful.
All right, good stuff. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to get deeper into the book when we come back. You can listen to Off the Shelf with Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger, and my guest, Carrie Gress, today. We'll be right back. Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger, and today we have Carrie Gress. We've been discussing her new book from Pan Books, The Marian Option, God's Solution to a Civilization in Crisis. And Carrie, last segment we were talking about the differences between the Marian Option and the Benedict Option. We touched upon the Rosary. Now I want to get a little deeper into the book. And an interesting section in part one, you used some descriptive words for Mary as, one, the most powerful woman in the world, and two, as a cultivator of culture. And those are some pretty hefty titles. Can you tell us how she fills these roles, particularly in what we're seeing going on in society today?
Sure. Well, the most powerful woman in the world title is certainly not unique to me. It actually came from a 2015 article from National Geographic, which, of course, is not known for its devotion to Catholicism. So it's pretty striking that they acknowledge that. But at the heart of it really is just the fact that you have, throughout history, this incredible amount of art, of music, of architecture, all of these kinds of elements that have been influenced largely by the inspiration of Mary, or Mary as a subject. I have a whole chapter talking about her role in culture and what she does to transform it. And one of the things that she does is she brings order to our lives, and order also brings beauty, because order beauty is proportionate and it's clear and all of those kinds of things. So those same sort of principles then apply to all these concrete or material arts. So if you look at cathedrals over in Europe, or the number of churches that are in Europe, Notre Dame Cathedral, This is a Gothic cathedral that was highly influenced by Our Lady. You know, so many of them are named Notre Dame. So that's an important element. Then even if you look at culture, I looked at, I think there's 135 of the most famous composers in the world. Well, 117 of them wrote major works devoted to Our Lady. So over and over again, you see, you know, everything from stained glass windows to just all of these elements are very alive. Even all those great little niches all over Europe that have different images of Mary throughout, you know, on street corners or little prayer corners, or I guess it wouldn't be a corner, but on a street where people stop and say a prayer to Our Lady. Her influence is definitely very much felt, I think, in Europe. And just as devotion to Our Lady rose, you can see sort of a correlation between that devotion and the height of culture that we see in certainly in the Renaissance.
Okay. So I'm going to bounce around here a little bit and flip forward to part three of the book, where you address an important topic and interesting title, Mariolatry or Mariology. And, of course, mm-hmm. as Catholics, we routinely hear the charges of being Mary worshippers. So in your view, how can we combat these obviously false charges?
Right. Well, I think it's a very hard thing because this seems to be a very ingrained issue. Particularly among Protestants. And so one of the things that is important to emphasize, of course, is that we don't worship Mary. And I talk about these different layers of veneration versus worship in the book. But I think it's just it's pernicious. But I think at the heart of it, we can see always that Mary is never pointing to herself the way that we see in literature or stories about goddesses. She's always pointing us back to her son. There's this incredibly deep humility there, and so that's really at the heart of it. But no, I think this is a difficult problem to address, and even trying to, you know, how do we share with our Protestant brethren this great love that we have for this woman who is so estimable, when in fact, you know, their own theology doesn't have the, you know, doesn't recognize it. And so I've been talking a lot about things like, you know, she's listed 19 times in the New Testament, so she's clearly biblical. But we also can tell a lot by just the fruits of devotion to her, and that's something that I think is more difficult to argue, but at the same time, it's also more compelling when people are open to looking at what it is that she's done. And that was one of the fun things about this book, was just getting a bird's-eye view of all of the things that she's done throughout history, not just looking at a particular theological or an apparition site of her, but to look at really these major geopolitical areas that she's influenced and so on. So, yeah, I think you're right. It's a big problem, but I think that's also one of the areas where just even our relationship with her and praying about this issue can help open the eyes of those who aren't open to understanding what it is that we see in the Mother of God.
So I want to dive into something here a little bit. You know, you have the book. It explains what the option is. How, just to simplify it a little bit more for us, you're a homeschooling mom. You know, I'm a dad that works at home. My wife stays at home. How can people incorporate the Marian option into their lives? Mm-hmm. Maybe a little at a time, and then overall how it will progress.
Sure. Well, I think that's a great question, and the answer is very simple. Really, we just have to ask her for her help. And that starts out, again, by returning to this idea of the rosary and praying the rosary as she's asked. It also can involve Marian consecration, which is, of course, a different and deeper layer of building this bond between her. But I think that what we can expect, I mean, this is sort of the exciting thing, is that there's so many people that talk about this, I can, you know, speak to it in my own life, is that she then will lead a soul to grow in virtues. She'll lead them to her son, but she'll also help us to discover what it is that God really wants of our own lives, what our own mission is. So there's one blogger who wrote about this, that he started praying. He did the Marian consecration, and shortly after that he discovered that he was called to live on a farm and, you know, raise cattle and, you know, all kinds of things. And certainly that wasn't my own experience. I'm in no way called to live on a farm, I think. But at the same time, that's the beauty of it, is that it works with exactly who we are, where we're at, our own needs, our own wounds, and focuses on growth from there and fruit for others from there, instead of just trying to have us all fit into one kind of option.
Mm-hmm. In a sense, it comes to us as long as we're willing to open ourselves up to it.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, at this point, too, I think motherhood is one of those things that's been under attack for a long time, and there are very few of us who don't need an incredible mother in our lives to guide us, to give us wisdom, to help us with whatever it is that the crosses that we're facing. And so that's the other fantastic piece, is that she's filled in those gaps in so many, you know, in every conceivable way that we need them.
Okay, so in another section of the book, you talk about what you call two different ages. We'll say anti-Mary or the age of Mary, where you discuss how in different ages or time periods, devotion to Mary has either been very strong, weak, or even visibly non-existent. Where would you categorize us today?
Well, this is an interesting chapter, because I think in many respects we can say that we're in both. We're in an anti-Mary age and a Marian age. And part of the reason I think this is, if you look throughout history at different eras, you see there's a problem, and then God provides a saint to help us with that solution. So St. Benedict is the solution to what's happening in, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire. You've got St. Francis shows up. He's the poverello, and it's at this particular time when the church is being choked with riches. You have the Jesuits show up at the Reformation. So time and again, you've got these different patterns of the God providing a solution or response to the different struggle of the age. And I think in our own days, particularly in the West, what we're seeing is really a desecration and a real confusion among women about what it means to be a woman, what motherhood means, what spiritual motherhood means, all of these kinds of questions. And so I think this is another reason why the Marian option is so relevant, because you have simultaneously this decimation of what it means to be woman, but then we also have this uptick of devotion to Mary, certainly through Vatican-approved apparitions, but also through the writings of the popes in the last century. I think Pope Leo XIII wrote something like 12 encyclicals to Mary alone. And then, you know, throughout those who came after him, John Paul II, of course, known as the Pope of the Rosary, Pope Benedict had a huge devotion to Our Lady, Pope Francis has a huge devotion to Our Lady. So there's a strong, strong emphasis upon her role. And so I think what we're seeing is she's being offered as the antidote to what it is that we're experiencing in this anti-Mary climate that we're living in today.
Okay. We'll get a little bit deeper in some of those points you brought up in the next segment. Right now, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Off the Shelf with Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger, here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back. From Tan Books. Got to mention it again. Awesome cover. And they tell you not to judge a book by its cover, but I tell you what, the cover's awesome, and once you crack it, you're going to enjoy the book as well. Really deep, good stuff, Carrie.
Thank you.
So I wanted to build on something we touched on briefly last segment, and that is with all the turmoil in our world today, you have a section in the book where you talk about Mary's geopolitical influence. And you look at how Mary plays a critical role in these areas today, and I think we need reminded that before we get into this conversation, that when we talk about time, we need to look at time through God's eyes and not our own limited perception of time as we get into each of these areas. And the first one you discuss in the book is you use Our Lady of Guadalupe and you focus on Islam and evangelization. And if there's ever a conversation that's worthy of having today, it's that Islam conversation with the extremism and the radicals that are out there. Can you tell us a little bit about what that section's about?
Sure. This was one of these chapters that I had no idea about going into doing the research on this. And it just went, as soon as I started, these threads started coming together, I was just overwhelmed and thought, you know, why is it we don't know this? A lot of us have talked about Lepanto and Our Lady's role there, but even the Battle of Lepanto is just sort of the tip of the iceberg to some of the threads that I discovered that Our Lady was influential in helping with. And it started, of course, with Spain. And Spain, back in the 700s, was taken over by Islam, either the Moors or the Saracens or the names of the different groups that took over. And for about 400 years, the Christians in Spain just sort of languished. I mean, they just were not making any headway in throwing the Moors out of the country. And, you know, they were trying all kinds of different saints, St. James, you know, asking for the intercession of various groups and doing all kinds of different strategies to try and regain the country, and nothing was working. And then finally, one general had the idea that maybe we should fight under the standard of Our Lady. And that's when they really started gaining back territory. And, you know, slowly, it still took another 400 years or so, but slowly territory came back to the Christians. And while that was happening, in 1326, there was a farmer who was out in the field one day, and he had this image of, this vision, rather, of the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen, and it was Our Lady of Guadalupe. A different Our Lady of Guadalupe. It was Mary saying, "My image is buried here. Please tell your priest, have him dig it up, build a church." And they called this image Our Lady of Guadalupe because it was found at the banks of the Guadalupe River in Spain. So you've got this first Our Lady of Guadalupe in Spain that already exists. So eventually, the Moors are pushed out in 1492, is sort of the last date, the last battle of Spain. And Ferdinand and Isabella, what do? To celebrate? Well, they go see Our Lady of Guadalupe in Spain and thank her for her intercession. They know she's behind this. And so, of course, that's the same year that they sponsor Columbus to go to a new world. Well, fast forward 40 years, and you've got the vision of the apparition of Our Lady of Guadalupe, who appears to St. Juan Diego. So it's interesting to see this connection between Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico, but also in Spain. And, of course, in Mexico, what she's doing is she's healing the wounds, there, the rift between the Aztecs or the native Mexicans as well as the Spaniards, but she's also converting the natives, you know, just tremendously. And she does that through the different images in the actual image of Our Lady of Guadalupe there in Mexico that speaks to the natives in a way that nothing else could or had up to that point. So long story short, what we're seeing is that there's this deep connection between Our Lady of Guadalupe in Spain and pushing out of Islam, but also all of these conversions. And this then spills over into these battles like Lepanto or the Battle of Vienna, which were very decisive in protecting Europe from Islam, where Our Lady of Guadalupe was invoked, where the rosary was prayed before these battles, which, you know, the Christians were certainly outnumbered. But because of their devotion to Our Lady, the weather would change or something happened in the battle so that the Christians ended up being victorious. And so I think this is, you know, part of the reason why we can see and say that she's been so influential in protecting Christianity from these invasions and from Islam, and as well as converting so many Muslims. There's great stories about her converting many of the men in Spain and elsewhere.
And I think it's important to point out when it comes to talking about Islam, and you pointed out in the book as well, that Mary's God has a relationship with Islam. She's mentioned, as you state in the Quran, some 34 times. And, a couple months ago in Abu Dubai, they renamed a mosque to Mary, Mother of Jesus. So she has an important role already in the Muslim religion. It's just dealing with the extremism such as ISIS that we're seeing today, and how she can help us hopefully convert those extremists.
Right, absolutely. Well, and I think that there's precedent for that. Some of my favorite stories were just the real stories of conversions that happened. And Our Lady knows her audience. She had the male Muslims had these terrifying dreams or experiences that then led them to conversion, whereas the females and the children had these very sweet experiences that led them back to the faith. So I think that's, part of the fruit of the rosary and things, something that we can do that, again, we're doing it from our armchair or just counting on our fingers when we go to bed or we're waiting in traffic or whatever. But the fruit is just remarkable if, again, we have the courage and the humility to ask and the patience to ask.
Right, right. And moving on in the book in this section, next you bring up Our Lady of Lourdes and you talk about humbling the proud and you focus on a particular saint that I find interesting, and that's Father Maximilian Kolbe. St. Kolbe, and you bring up the point that the last piece of writing to come from his pen, and I'm actually reading from the book right now, before he was sent to Auschwitz was, "The Holy Spirit is the uncreated Immaculate Conception."
Right, right. Yeah, this was a fascinating piece also for me to discover, because I think, I had always just associated Lourdes with sort of St. Bernadette, and I thought it was sort of very local to France and whatnot, but the more that I looked and did Marian research, I was astounded to find this connection to Maximilian Kolbe. And his real pressing question that he had through most of his priesthood was, why did Our Lady say, "I am the Immaculate Conception"? Why didn't she say, "I was immaculately conceived"? And this was something he just struggled with and prayed about and tried to work through. And like you said, what he stumbled upon right before he went to Auschwitz was this idea that the Holy Spirit was the uncreated Immaculate Conception, and she, as the spouse of the Holy Spirit, is the created Immaculate Conception. And so you see these two sides of the coin of the spousal relationship that they have to one another. And again, this is the fruit of what came through Our Lady of Lourdes. There's a lot of things happening at Lourdes, of course. The healings among them are significant. But this is another piece that has led to a deeper understanding of who Mary is and her relationship with the Holy Spirit and the Trinity and just what it is that she brings to us through that fruitful relationship.
And I think right now, since we're discussing it, we should give a tip of the hat to Maximilian Kolbe for his work and promotion of Marian devotion and Immaculate Conception before his death at Auschwitz.
Yes, no, and he was obviously an incredible herald of what it is that, of Our Lady and of Mariology, and just went very, very deep and even was acknowledged by Pope Paul VI in particular, as well as John Paul II, for being this harbinger of deeper work on Our Lady that hadn't been done before.
Excellent. So, and then in the last section about the Marian apparitions, you discuss Our Lady of Fatima. Obviously, that's getting a lot of attention these days with the 100th anniversary. And you tie it to, again, conquering communism. Some people, I think, believe communism is a dated argument, but, I mean, obviously the Russians are involved in our election. Just kidding. Had to go there. So tell us about Our Lady of Fatima and conquering communism.
Sure. Well, I think there's nothing dated about communism at this point. We still see there's over a billion people who are living under communism in the world today, in China and North Korea and Cuba and so on. But I think Fatima is fascinating because it's not finished yet. There's still something left open about it that we didn't ever see sort of a closure to it the way that we saw, or an end to it the way that we saw with the others, because of the secret of Fatima and those kinds of elements that were unique to it. But Yeah, it's certainly John Paul II was at the heart of her work, and we know of his own Marian devotion, and how the Soviet Union ended without even a single shot. I mean, that alone and of itself is mm-hmm. is absolutely miraculous. But there's actually some work by a professor in Poland that's just been translated into English by a professor named Richard Legutko. And I think the book is called Demon of Democracy. But his point is that a lot of the materialism that we saw in communism has actually spread to the West, and that what we struggle with in the West is basically the same problem of materialism that we saw and of progress that we saw in communism, but it's in a different disguise. And this is one of the reasons why there was so much collusion between former communists and the Western progressives that we see certainly in Western Europe, but also in our own country, that they're trying to remake everything and reorder everything, so that it has no connection with the past. And of course, we can see this in our own culture today, whether it's transgenderism, all of the relationship to gender mm-hmm. is part of this, the separation with anything that smacks of religion. All of those kinds of elements play into this. So, to say that communism is dead and that this is a, dried up argument is, in fact, really to miss the bigger point of what's going on here mm-hmm. In the rest and in the West and in the rest of the world.
Very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. Because if we've ever been in a time period that needed something like the Marian option, I think it's today. Our society here mm-hmm. in the West is very ingrained in relativism. We're very ingrained in the materialism you discussed in the sense that everybody's after being number one, owning all the mm-hmm. things that they can, just consuming items, even though they don't really need them. They've lost sight of what's important in life and that, when you die, you're not taking any of that with you. That doesn't even talk about what you mentioned there about the redefinition, the attempt, we shall say, of the redefinition of marriage, redefinition of human identity. We're in dire straits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's without a doubt. And I think that's one of the best things about the Marian option is just even looking at, all of these different occasions. I only looked at approved Marian options. I'm sorry, approved Marian apparitions. Mm-hmm. So there are 15 that have been Vatican approved, and I think I use 9. But among these, you've got certainly the scapular. You've got the miraculous medal. You've got the rosary. You've got Our Lady coming and asking repeatedly. And there's so many different things that she has made available to us to help us help ourselves through her and through her son, that it almost, when I was looking through this, it almost gets laughable. Like, how, stiff-necked can we be that we're missing all of these pieces and these different ways that they have tried to reach us, continually. But I think that's what's so hopeful, is that it's just so clear that she's so intent on helping us, even in this great darkness, and that we can trust that she's can do these things. It's, again, we just have to ask and do our part, and it doesn't have to be complicated, and we don't have to jump through hoops. And I think it's just incredibly hopeful. I know it's changed my own perspective about the world in which we live, especially with 4 small children. Mm-hmm. You know what it's like,
yep.
Worrying about what are we leaving our children, and just the heaviness of that day in and day out. And now I have a much greater sense of her role, and even in the very small things in daily life, how she will help us with the tiniest of things that we think are not important, but she's there like a good mother to really help us with all of them.
All right. Good closing thought for this segment. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back for the last segment, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf with Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger, and my guest, Carrie Gress, today. We'll be right back. back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Soxica, the book blogger. We've been spending today with Terry Gress, the author of The Marian Option, God's Solution to a Civilization in Crisis. And Terry, we covered a lot of ground on your book. I want to read a little portion out of your book. It's the opening paragraphs to chapter 12, and I think it fits the conversation we've been having. And it says, "We live in dark times, and our media-driven culture has made us more aware of the struggles of our culture has before us. The news cycle contributes to an increase in general chaos, violence, and uneasiness instead of peace, solace, and hope." And I think that's a very telling paragraph, very telling few sentences, because probably perhaps more so than in any period of time that civilization has been in, news spreads, the media can manipulate it, and it puts us in a very bad situation with what we face, what we deal with.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think spiritually it can be very corrosive. I was talking with someone the other day who's really caught up in the news cycle and I think struggling with trying to keep our own peace. And this is something that as Catholics we have to be focused on, because we can't give what we don't have. And if we're constantly sort of living with this frenetic pace of the news cycle, you know, our smartphones are in front of us all the time. And, you know, I'm, of course, as guilty of this as anyone. So we have to be mindful that this is not helping us. And this is one of the fruits of the rosary, things that can happen because of the fact that it restores us to a kind of peace that we're not getting from the world, and it's sort of interior life that certainly the world is not giving us and is actually robbing us of. And I think this is what makes us different as Catholics. If we don't have these outward signs of peace, you know, some of us have joy. Not all of us do. Some of us are more melancholic than others. But at the same time, peace is one of those hallmarks that we can have and throughout the ages. In fact, I love that part of the Mass where it says, "My peace I give you, my peace I leave with you." It's already a gift that Christ has given to us. We just have to tap into it. We have to be willing to be open to it and recognize that this is something that we have to guard and protect. And, you know, almost like a candle, it can be blown out so easily, but we have to do our part to maintain that within our own souls so that it can be shared and the fruit of it can be experienced by those around us, particularly our families, but also those who are non-believers outside of our immediate family.
Got it. So, as I mentioned, we covered a lot of ground about the book. Is there anything we missed that you want to share with us?
You know, I think it's kind of on the same point that we're talking about. I had a question the other day. Someone asked me about the rosary, and she said, "You know, I've been praying this for a long time, and I see plenty more rosary decades in the future, and I feel like I've kind of tapped out the mysteries. You know, how many different ways can you pray it and whatnot?" And one of the things that I shared with her was just the fact that there's a lot more to the rosary than just those mysteries. But in fact, there's one Mariologist that I talk about in the book, Monsignor Johann Rothen, who is a friend of Pope Benedict XVI, Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the rosary as a kind of pilgrimage, that we actually, you know, when we go on a pilgrimage, we prepare for it, we go, we have these expectations of things happening, things do happen, and then we return to the world. And maybe the things that happen aren't what we expect, but nevertheless, we return to the world kind of a different person and transformed. And he said that's what the rosary is, that we can have this experience of leaving daily life and experiencing something new. And it's this mystery of what Our Lady can give to us through that experience that will really transform us. And I think there's also just the element of dialogue in that. I was sharing with this young woman that I had the experience a long time ago where I was able to pray three mysteries of the rosary while I was out walking. And I would always notice in the second mystery, I would have these insights that I would just have to write down because they were just remarkable. But it wouldn't happen in the first mystery. It wouldn't happen in the third mystery. It always happened in the second mystery. And, you know, I think God has these different patterns for us of the way that the Holy Spirit will speak to us through them. You know, that it's not just a matter of focusing and thinking that we're doing something wrong if these ideas come to us or ideas come to us, but in fact, recognizing that there is going to be a pattern the way God speaks to us and gets his own message to us through the rosary.
Good stuff. So You have a couple other books I'd like to touch upon while we still have some time together today. The first one, Nudging Conversions, A Practical Guide to Bringing Those You Love Back to the Church. What's that one all about?
You know, this is a book that I wrote in a month. It was one of these, once I had the idea for it, I just was so easy to write because so much of it was based on my own experience with my immediate family of helping them come back to the faith. And really at the heart of it is just this idea that evangelization is something that is a fruit of our own experience. So if we've got people, we've got family members in particular around us that we want to come back to the faith, the first place that we have to start is really on our own life and really, you know, making sure that we are focused on the sacraments and that we're doing our part to grow in holiness. But I think the other piece of it is that we often think about evangelization in terms of, you know, I just need the right argument, or I just need to say this, or if I could only remember to say this, you know, respond in this way to what it is that they're coming at me with. And that's not really where, you know, from my experience, this is not what converted people. In fact, that ended up making my relationships much more strained. And what ended up happening was that I realized that I needed to back off from that kind of dialogue with my family and just love them exactly where they were at, which meant I didn't have to embrace the sinful things that they were doing or encourage them in that. But I did have to be there and be present for them and love them and, you know, share their life with them in a real and meaningful way. And it was remarkable how dramatically then all of the pieces kind of fit together when that trust was established and, you know, we could move further. And they knew that when they did encounter problems, they could trust me. And from there, it really led to the conversion of their own hearts in many different and mysterious ways, but beautiful ways.
Interesting. Next, Ultimate Makeover, The Transforming Power of Motherhood. I don't think this would be a book geared towards me.
Yeah, you probably wouldn't appreciate this book too much. But this was my own experience of motherhood where I found motherhood to be the hardest thing that I had ever done as far as just the amount of perseverance involved and just the day in and day out and really even this the change to my own identity. And I think a lot of women experience this, and as a result, they want to wish it away. You know, can we just move on here? And I think that wishing it away is what has been really detrimental to our own culture because we find very few women who are in their 70s and 80s now who have this kind of wisdom that women used to have. And I think that there's something very important about those early years of motherhood and the later years of motherhood that help form us and transform us into those beautiful women that have this kind of wisdom and radiate joy and peace and you know, all those things that we crave from them. And so it actually goes through how it is that happens. And in motherhood, all of our vices are really transformed into virtue. We become, you know, for those of us who were impatient before we were married, motherhood makes us persevere and, you know, and the like. So there's just virtue and vice that I explain what they mean, but also how it is that just on a daily basis we become more beautiful and much more like the women that we admire and that we want to become like and what we see ourselves to be, you know, in our final years of our life.
Got it. Ladies, good book for you, sounds like. And the last one, the one I am familiar with, the one you co-authored mm-hmm. with George Weigel, City of Saints, A Pilgrim's Guide to John Paul II's Krakow. That was a very interesting read. Can you tell us a little
yeah,
bit about that?
Thank you. Sure. Yeah, this is a book I actually started working on in 2005 around the time of John Paul II's death. And I went to Krakow and spent some time there. I'd been there many times before, but I went there expressly to research this. And I decided, you know, this is just not a book that's going to be a big seller at this point because nobody's really going to Krakow. John Paul II's passed away now, and I just don't see this working. So then, of course, when Pope Francis announced that World Youth Day was going to be in Krakow, I contacted Weigel and said, you know, I have this book that I worked on. You know, can I still write it? And so he ended up coming to lunch, and we talked about it, and we decided that we would just write it together. And so it was really a privilege to write because each chapter is in two parts. He writes the relevant parts of John Paul II's life, and I speak about the areas in Krakow. And at the heart of it is we're trying to describe how it is that Poland formed this man that we came to know as John Paul II, and that it wasn't an accident that he was from Poland, but in fact they instilled in him all these incredible virtues that he probably couldn't have gotten just anywhere. So it was great to be able to look at very specific places that formed him, whether it's Wawel Castle or his life, you know, as a small child, And all of these different areas that formed him into the man of John Paul II.
Awesome. So we've run out of time. Carrie, I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule and spending it with us today.
Thank you, Pete. It's really my pleasure.
And before we leave, I want to give you the opportunity to tell people where they can find all these books from and your work.
Sure. The best place, my website is probably the easiest place, carriegress.com. Amazon's got all of them, and Tan Books has got the Marian option as well. So they're certainly readily available. I know a lot of Catholic bookstores are carrying them at this time as well.
Excellent. So with that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And until next time, God bless.